This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Catherine.
Yes.
You've had a request.
Yeah.
Tell us what it is.
It's really good. So Jane from Text got in touch with me and said that Radio National, the book show, are running another literary debate.
So you say you had me at Radio National. Really? I am now that demographic.
Well, do you know last year they did a debate? It was about...
It's about representation,
yeah. It was.
Bram, Claire G. Coleman... Mel
Graham
Chang was
Simpson.
In there. Graham, that's right.
Yep, all discussing Write What You Know.
Write What You Know, that's
that was
what it
the
was.
Topic. So they have another debate planned. It'll be coming up, I think it's the 27th of November at the State Library, but
Fantastic.
Then the show will air in early December.
Excellent. But you can get along to it in person and
yeah,
watch it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I so enthusiastically said yes,
of
100%,
course.
Totally.
Put me on the debate team.
And also to the extent that I said, which team am I on? Can I please be first speaker? Because first speaker is the easiest position.
Catherine Collette, were you first speaker when you were at school?
No. Well, this is the thing. I've been researching a fair bit about debates because one of my characters is a debater.
Okay.
But then as soon as I sent the series of emails, like super flattered, I realised I've never done a debate.
Never?
So
you
no,
were not in the debating
I've
team?
I've never done a debate.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm super excited about it. But I'm hoping I get first speaker.
Yeah, first speaker's good. I'm still scarred, I remember. So I was in the debating team, but I was like the fourth.
Terrible.
No. I was always kind of like the debaters, and I still am very good friends with two of the debaters. They were a cracking team, so I was only ever kind of emergency. But I do remember one time using the word weird in my rebuttal, like saying, because that was just weird. And I got taken down so far, and I have... I reckon until that moment when I just did it on the podcast right then, very rarely used the word weird in the rest of my life.
Really?
Because it was seen that they were just like, oh, that was such a cop out. Yeah,
yeah.
Very poor.
Yeah. I do remember watching a debate where one of the speakers said that was just stupid. And
yeah, same.
It's the same kind of takedown. I remember that very well. Same kind
See?
Of thing.
Look at the lessons learned.
Yeah,
from
I will
debating.
Not be.
So do you know the topic yet?
I do. It escapes me in this very moment.
And
but
do you know your team
complicated.
Members?
Complicated. No, I don't know anything. They're calling me next week.
That's really exciting. So
yeah,
this is the kind of thing that you say yes to because you are involved in our industry at large. You get to meet new writing people.
I'm super excited.
What we wanted to talk about today was kind of like what we do to support other writers and our industry. And that's just the perfect example of how we do it. What else do you do?
Okay, so we're going to go back and forth.
Yeah.
I think one thing I learned, I have a friend whose friend, so we're like this, set up an online thing called Booko. I don't know if you've heard of Booko.
I have not, but
so
I will be
Booko
putting it immediately
is,
on my phone.
Maybe not.
Okay, hold.
So Booko is, I used to buy all my online books through Booko. You basically log on to Booko and then you write what book you want and then it searches all of the bookshops in the world and uses your postcode to work out where in the world you can buy the book. It includes like secondhand books and stuff.
Yeah,
where
right.
in the world you can get that book the cheapest. I used to always buy on Booko. So I would get books from, I mean, it's not very environmentally friendly. I knew that much. But I would get books from the UK, from the US, blah, blah, blah.
I see.
But now I know that you do not want to be buying books from overseas.
You want to support your indie bookstore.
Exactly. So I still buy a lot of books online, but I don't use Booko. I either do Booktopia, I do a lot of, or I go through bookshops like Readings is the other big one I buy from.
Yep. And do you do in-person to the bricks and mortar as well?
I do that less.
Yep.
I love going into Readings.
Yep.
There's one, the closest bookshop to me is probably, or the one that I am nearest the most is Robinson's in Northland.
Oh, yep.
I do a lot of kids' books there.
Yeah.
But I probably am a buy books. I don't want to go to a book. Like, I want the book now.
I want, yeah.
So I just want to put
Kindle,
it in the post.
Yeah,
and I Kindle a lot.
See, I'm still addicted to the book, and also I don't have a Kindle. So I'm very lucky to have a very local to me, like in my little hamlet, as they like to call Hurstbridge, gorgeous kids bookstore called Pickwick and Sprout. Shout out to you, Amy. And she does amazing stuff and lots of events and stuff as well.
Yeah.
So she's great. And I also have the Eltham Bookshop. Shout out to them. Who do an incredible array of events. And I've said this before on the podcast, I think Mira's sold more copies of Skylarking than anyone in the country. Because I think that that's what they do so well. Local yep. authors, you know, the yep. bookshops support local authors. I also totally do Booktopia and readings online.
If there was one in Preston Market, like yep. in that real Preston precinct,
yep.
that would probably change.
Opportunity right there because, you know, there is a lot of money in bookstores, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so buy.
Think of who you buy from.
Think of who you buy from. And I also would add to that, think of who you're buying. So my general philosophy is that I buy Australian writers. I buy the smaller independent kind of publishers if I can, and I get my, you know, Man Booker books or whatever I put on hold at the library is yep. my general kind of philosophy.
Yep. I think that's great. Connected with that, I try to buy 99% of presents books.
Yes.
Books for particularly kid, wearing like peak
yeah.
kid present gift thing. Peak. And I also try, similar to what you said, to buy Australian and also not to yep. buy bestsellers.
Yes.
Because
they're
the
already
books
getting.
That do well are
Guys,
already going
to
do well.
Trent Dalton, we love you, Trent, and we're hoping to yep. chat to you next year. But you've sold enough books, mate. Like
yeah. Treehouse,
don't
always
buy
gonna
that
sell,
book
not
for anyone.
Treehouse
yeah,
for
yeah,
anyone.
Yeah, exactly. And also talk to your bookseller about what's
exactly.
new and exciting, and they will tell you as well, I think is really important. What else? Okay, so we've got the buying of books. What else can you do to support your fellow writers?
Easy as shout out on socials.
Shout outs.
I know.
Remember, not look at my hat, but I like your hat made by
exactly.
whoever.
Exactly.
Shout outs on the socials all the time, especially, you know, articles, blog posts, those little bits, just a retweet.
Yeah.
I often do the love this retweet, just send it out there.
I'm a bit off socials at the moment though.
That's okay. You're allowed to be off socials.
Yeah.
I think the personal shout out too, I mean, we know that word of mouth works best, right? So like tell your mum about a book.
That's true. Actually, I do recommend a lot of books to people.
Yeah. People and people would look to you. Like I know that lots of my friends, I don't even realise that they're checking my Instagram to see what I'm reading and they've said, oh yeah, I read that because you said it was good. I'm like, God, the pressure, the pressure. But let's also note, I recently shared something, from the podcast, Elizabeth Gilbert had posted, and she's fantastic. You follow her if you're on Instagram. She says lovely things. But it was kind of a post about saying lovely things, because she was like, some of you have got in contact to say, you know, I love too many things. I'm always saying nice things. Like, where is my kind of critical faculties about saying this wasn't so great? And she's like, well, I'm not telling you about those things because
she's a good position to
you
take,
know, let's just celebrate. And I did do this recently where, you know, ostensibly my Instagram is a list of all the books I read. It's not, because there's some that I read that I don't like, and I'm not going to
grade.
Yeah. Well, I'm just not going to post about them because you know what? There's enough people sitting around looking at their Goodreads going, oh God, that I'm just not going to kind of add
not
to that.
If it's lukewarm.
Yeah. I'm not going to do takedowns.
I also really like Nina Kenwood. I think I mentioned this the other week. On her website has a page that is books I love.
Mm.
I really like this concept. So
yeah.
It's just a list of books that are kind of her favorite reads.
Yeah. I think that's really good.
For someone to read, and it's just a good way of promoting other people's work. And you feel like you get to know a person through there.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, it's really
she
intimate,
has whittled
actually.
Down to 15 books that
yeah.
she is standing by.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I need to get started on that list.
Yeah.
On that too, I think putting people's names forward. So someone asks me to do a gig, I can't do the gig, and instead of saying, no, I can't do the gig, I say, I can't do it, but how about A, B, or C, my amazing writer friends? Or, you know, like just sharing the love that way too. I think lots of people do that kind of automatically, but it's nice to think about doing it as a key part of how you celebrate your community. I was going to add.
Yes.
Letters of support, like reading for people, like there's other stuff that we do that isn't shout outs, that isn't so kind of in the public realm, which
yep.
is those types of things that we do when we do a beta read for someone, or we put someone in contact with an agent, or we write a letter of support for somebody's grant proposal, you know, and I think that that stuff is really important to do as well.
I think that because I've been grappling with this thing of I feel bad that I'm like I feel dutifully like I should be on social media, but I don't.
Yeah.
I'm just not into it.
Yeah.
But I think the answer would be to write. One of the things that I loved when the helpline came out is when people write you an email and say, like, that is the best thing. And I think I should instigate that more.
That's really good. Maybe you could put it down as like, you know, I'm going to do this 10 times a year or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm going to just get in contact
favorite ones.
Yeah, with that person. It does really
it's
warm
so
the cockles
nice.
Of your heart.
It does.
It is an absolute thrill to have Charlotte Wood finally here in our little studio. Though she needs no introduction, I will. Charlotte Wood is the Sydney-based author of 6 novels and 2 books of nonfiction. Her first novel, Pieces of a Girl, which I managed to find, much to her distress, was published to critical acclaim in 1999. Her 5th novel, The Natural Way of Things, won the 2016 Stella Prize, the 2016 Indie Book of the Year and Novel of the Year, and was joint winner of the Prime Minister's Literary Award for Fiction. And was the University of Canberra Book of the Year, where they gave a copy to everyone. It's the most extraordinary strategy. I love it. Charlotte's nonfiction work includes The Writer's Room, a collection of interviews with authors about the creative process, and Love and Hunger, a book about cooking. In 2019, Charlotte was made a member of the Order of Australia for significant services to literature and was named one of AFR's 100 Women of Influence. Which I love so much. Charlotte's latest novel is The Weekend. Thank you so much for coming to speak to
us. It's such a delight to be here, Kate.
Charlotte, you are deep in your tour.
I am.
How does a tour for a 6th novel look like compared to your tour for your first novel? Did you even have a tour?
I did not have a tour for my first novel. They were actually really good to me with my first novel, you know, when I look back, considering how little it sold. I did quite a few festivals, but I didn't have a tour. You know, I did a few bookshop gigs in Sydney, but, you know, so long ago I can barely remember, but I certainly did not. I mean, this is really possibly the first full-on tour I've done.
Okay, and what does it look like? You've had a bunch of events.
I'm in week 2 now probably. I think last week I did 5 events in Sydney. And I've done, I think, 4 or 5, I can't remember, in Melbourne.
And that's part of it. Of course you can't remember because it's massive.
And then bookshop visits. So the events are in the evenings generally at bookshops, interviews, you know, fantastic, signing books there. And then during the day doing a bit of media and radio interviews and so on, and podcast interviews with excellent people. And then bookshop visits, signing loads of stock. I feel like I've signed every possible book of mine in print. And actually,
so
you know, you could maybe in the future get lots of money for a book that I haven't signed.
What has your signature changed over time, your process of signing?
I imagine so. One of the booksellers said to me yesterday, oh, that's good. It's not quite a straight line yet. Apparently Jonathan Franzen's just a straight line. Mine's kind of a big swirl for the sea and the rest just a bit of scribble.
Charlotte, you were just saying that you're relying on Manuka Honey a little bit to get you through. How do you prep yourself for this kind of intense period of touring?
Well, it's funny we're talking about this as if I know, because really I've never done it to this extent before. With The Natural Way of Things, I did loads and loads and loads of speaking, but it was spread out over a year. So I didn't do this huge sort of hit
intense
in the first week of publication. And this is fantastic, actually, because it's apparently the book is selling really well and it's that thing of getting momentum.
Yeah.
So the other thing I love about touring is being in a car for the whole day with publicists and behind the scenes book people who tell you how it all works, you know. I mean, you think that I would know by now, but it's that side, you know, the other inside the sausage machine or whatever they call it, which I tend to try and avoid knowing too much about in lots of ways, but I'm also interested in it.
Yeah, as we all are.
I don't think it's all that healthy for authors to obsess about it.
Yep.
Well, it's not healthy at all to obsess about it, but it is interesting. So, see, I've lost the question already. So prep, what I did do, this is making me laugh because I haven't done any of this stuff, but I generally have quite a bad back and I get a lot of RSI and stuff. So I saw my beautiful physio and she gave me this great program of Pilates exercises. I've got my TheraBand, you know, that stretchy band for the hotel room.
Amazing.
Thing. Fully Fantastic. Prepped. Fully prepped. Have I done any of that?
Of course you haven't.
Well, I haven't really, almost haven't had time. But one thing I did say to Jane, the publicist, and Jane, the publisher, all the cool Janes, was that I'm not going to do any dinners after events. You know, quite often the booksellers who are just being lovely will say, come out, we'll take you out for dinner or you see, you know, I've got friends in all these cities I'm going to who I would love to see, but I can't keep it up. So I'm going straight back to the hotel and getting room service and conking out, you know, as early as possible.
That's really interesting. And I'm so glad that you said it too, because I think often people talk about the energy output of all the talking and all the being lovely. Like you got to smile a lot and
you have to be nice. Yeah. And, you know,
and I think the nature of your book as well, is that you've probably got people who are, I even know, I saw you at an event this week at Northcote Library and a woman in the audience talked about one of her friends recently passing away. Like you've got people giving you also a lot of their emotional stuff and giving you stories. It must be exhausting.
And, well, you know, the last book, The Natural Way of Things, that was certainly the case and they were often quite distressing stories. Whereas these, so far, it's been really nice. It's women saying, oh, my God, I've just come back from a weekend away with my best friends I've known for 30 years or 40 years or whatever. But it is putting out your personal energy and also sort of hyping you up, you know. So I go back to the hotel and then it'll take me at least 2 hours to just get back to normal adrenaline levels and then, you know, do some reading and go to sleep. So if I went out for dinner on top of that, it'd be like 2 a.m. before I could stop being so wired and go to sleep. So
I know this is the first time you've done such a kind of big intense one. How much time do you predict you'll need to get back to a space where you can write again after all of this?
Well,
or are you in it already?
No, I'm not in it. Okay, I mean, it's fascinating to me how many people say you write on tour. I don't know how.
No, I don't know.
I just don't know. I couldn't, my brain doesn't work that way because this is in sort of hyper externalizing mode and writing is the complete opposite of that.
Yep.
Like low key and private and bored and quiet. So it certainly doesn't work for me to do that. But I've blocked out a couple of weeks in, not consecutive weeks, but in November there's sort of 4 or 5 days where we've blocked out for no events. But I've got a couple of essays to write.
Okay.
So that's what I'll do first. And I've got deadlines for those in November and December. And that's kind of good in a way because I think it's a good way to just
ease your way back.
My way back. And then, look, I think it'll probably realistically be almost next year before I sit down properly and get back in the rhythm of it. Because, you know, then there's December and holidays and Christmas.
Yeah, crazy times. Charlotte, tell me, I should go back to the start. I launched straight in and I should tell our listeners too, and regular listeners will know that while this is the first time this week that you and I have met in the flesh, Charlotte, we have talked quite a bit
because
I did such an incredible mentorship with you, which I've talked about at different times on the podcast.
So we met on Skype.
We did.
Many times.
We've met
never
on Skype,
actually
but it's
in
just
the same
completely
room.
Different like this, although the sound of your voice in my ears is very familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the first time you saw your words in print. I know that you've got a former life as a journalist. Was it then or earlier?
In print. Well, I sort of separate my journalism life from my real writing life, I would say. So in journalism, you know, like
didn't
work experience on the local paper.
Yeah.
Writing, you know, there was a car crash on the corner.
Is that how you started? That was the...
That was my first job.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, that was fine. It was kind of interesting. I wish that I'd been older when I had that job because it actually could be a great job.
Yeah.
If you weren't a, you know, 18-year-old idiot like I was.
Did you want to be a writer at that time?
Not really. No, I didn't know. I think I always wanted to be a writer, but I didn't know that I wanted to be a writer. So I was, you know, like every writer probably, I loved English at school. I was top of the class in English. I loved writing essays. I loved reading, all of that. And I just thought, well, journalism is, that's, the only thing you can do with that sort of, you know, interest. And I remember people saying to me when I was, you know, in my early 20s or something, oh, maybe you'll write a novel one day, and me thinking, oh, what? How could I possibly do that? that's not what would I write a novel about?
Yeah.
You know. So, but the first time I saw my real writing imprint was, it was in an anthology of women's writing. You know, in 19. I was trying to think. Had my mum died yet? I think she had. So it must have been 1994 or 1995. Oh, no, maybe it was slightly earlier than that. That's right. And so it was this tiny little kind of vignette, really. It wasn't a story. It wasn't anything. But it was in this very sweet little thing published by, you know, the Women's Feminist Press or something, which my creative writing teacher made me enter into it there. And so that was very exciting. And then I didn't really do anything for a few years writing-wise because I think I just thought I'll get around to it one day. Then after my mum died, I kind of had this urgent feeling, and I was 29 then, that, you know, when those big things happen in your life, things separate into important things and unimportant things.
Yep.
And I suddenly knew this was an important thing and I wanted to properly apply myself and try it, really commit and write something. So I went off to community classes. I'd done creative writing at uni and stuff, but then I went off. And then, you know, I think I had a couple more of those sort of drab little vignette-y things published here and there. And then, but my book was published when I was just about 35, I think.
And how did it come? Did you submit through the normal, like, were you a slush pile person?
No,
did you have
I had
an agent
this
by
bizarre,
then?
Easy experience with my first novel, not so with my second novel. But I did a couple of fellowships and mentorship things at Varuna,
yep.
The Writer's House, which I'm sure
wonderful
your listeners
Varuna.
Know about. And I had this fantastic thing that was then called an editorial mentorship, I think, with Judith Lucan Amundsen, who was a brilliant editor. And at the end of that week with her, she said, well, I think this book is finished. And I was like, what? That can't be right. I should have to work for another 4 years or something. I mean,
bleed
I'd been writing on it. I mean, you know, it had been hard, but I just, you know, I didn't know what a finished book looked like. Anyway, and she said, would you like me to take it to a publisher that I think would be interested? And I'm like, yes, please.
Yes, please.
And like within a week I had, that's right, at that time there was a fantastic Melbourne agent called Fran Bryson, and she was in town and she came to some readings at the, you know, at Varuna in the evening. She came up to me after the thing and said, oh, you know, when you finish, get in touch with me. Anyway, so I had this weird, weird day where I got a call from the publisher saying, this was Picador back then, saying, would you, you know, I'm very interested in your book. Would you like to come in for a chat about it? Then I rang Judith, the editor, and said, oh, what does this mean? And she said, it means you get on the phone to that agent right now. So I got on the phone to the agent and she basically said, I mean, it was sort of fairly clear that they wanted the book. So I was on the phone to her as I walked into the office of the publisher and she said, just tell them I'm representing you. I went, okay.
Oh, so, my goodness.
So it was all sort of done and dusted in a week. And
wow.
It was quite a good deal and all of that. And so I was like, oh, people say this is really difficult, but
it's not that hard at all.
It's not that hard at all.
And then you experienced and you experienced success with that. Like it was shortlisted. You were like the hot young, you know, shortlisted for SMH Novelist of the Year. All those things
I know, but that Novelist of the Year thing was very funny because there were sort of two people chosen as the real ones and then three sort of also-rans. And I was one of the also-rans and I'm proud to say that Christos Tsiolkos was also one of the also-rans.
Well, see, sometimes
and,
pays to be an also-ran.
And that was kind of funny. I mean, it was shortlisted for a couple of things, but, you know, I had to laugh when you said it was successful. You know, it sank like a stone pretty much and got pulped within, you know.
Pulped. Oh, God.
Oh, the word.
Oh, the word. It just hurts me.
I know. It's a terrible word for new novelists to hear in particular.
No, no one should ever say it, ever.
But the thing is, we're going to pulp it, so do you want to buy any before we pulp it?
Because you put that bit in your contract that says, contact me before
they have
do
to offer you the.
Oh, mate.
So, yeah, I'll have another 5 copies.
Yes, please. I'll give them to my friends.
Anyway.
So then what happened for your second? So you said, yeah, didn't work that way for your second.
No, it did not. And I think this is a really good thing for novelists to know because we're told that, you know, getting the first one is so hard, blah, 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 blah. I think actually getting the second one published is harder. Because when you're an unknown, somebody in the business said to me once, an agent that I very much admire, she said, look, publishing loves a virgin.
Yeah. And so true.
So true, because they don't know that you're a failure yet.
No.
So then when you've done your first novel and it's a weird little, you know, lyrical, quiet, whatever book that nobody wants to read, by the time your second novel comes out, they go, oh, yeah, you write those sort of little books that nobody wants. So anyway, the second novel was taken to my then publisher. They rejected it. I got the biggest shock of my life. I was devastated. I was ashamed at how devastated I was. Mm. I mean, it was like grief, like real grief. And then I felt so bad because it's like, oh, how can I be so upset about this and blah-de-blah. Blah. The great thing was that the next person who saw it was Jane Palfreyman, who loved it, and I've been with her ever since, and she is, you know, that was the best thing that ever happened to me, basically. Yeah.
What was the time frame between that rejection and Jane Palfreyman? Because I think
eternity.
Yeah, it feels like eternity either way, and I think what people do in that time is so significant because you did put it out there again.
Yeah, well, it was very, you know, I learned so much in that time. So the first thing I did was completely fall apart.
Yeah.
The second thing I did was kind of just hang around badgering my agent, who eventually, and she said, I'm going to send it to Jane Palfreyman. And so I'm like, okay, well, you know, 5 minutes later, why haven't I heard back? I rang her, you know, like things that I would never do now in a million years. I would not ring my agent and go, have you heard? Have you heard? And I think that's a very good thing to learn very quickly.
Absolutely.
That you do not, you know, if there is news, you will hear it. You know, you'll be the first person to hear it.
Yeah.
But, and I, eventually my agent then, Fran, got a little bit kindly frustrated with me and said, look, a writer writes, go and write something else. And I was like, oh, okay, I haven't got anything else to do. And it was several months, I think, between sending it out. And it was over Christmas and then the whole publishing industry vanishes.
Yeah.
So it was sort of February. I think it might have been around October or something that, you know, I got the bad news. And then anyway, but the great thing was that I started my third book, which was called The Children. And I remember this one amazing day where I was so into the new book that I thought, oh, I don't care about that other one anymore. This is going to be better anyway. And so whatever. You know, that was a fleeting thought because then I did really want it to be published again. But
it was the act of getting back.
Yes.
And
going
writing.
Back to the page, back to the work. And I could see that that would be the thing that would always save me. You know?
And that's obviously been, is that a lesson you've
Yeah.
Kept.
I mean, I haven't had a rejection like that since. I've had plenty internationally.
Yeah.
Always. Until recently. But you know, and then that second book was The Submerged Cathedral. Jane loved it. It was shortlisted for the Mars Franklin. It was, you know, it didn't sell very well, but it's still in print, which is amazing to me. And there are people who love that book.
Yeah.
There are, you know, it's really nice way down the track when someone comes to an event and they've got their old, tattered
copy.
Old, and I love that.
How do you feel? I was reading back over some of your essays and speeches that I've loved, and there's part where you describe your feelings about your first book, about Pieces of a Girl.
What did I say?
You said, for many years after I wrote it, I was ashamed. Mm. It seemed so childish, so macabre, so strange. Do you feel differently about each of your books? Or do you feel like each of them has just got better and better? You've known your craft better and better.
Well, the craft I've certainly got better at. I know that. It's funny. The first one is the one I still feel a bit kind of squeamish about.
Have you heard other writers describe that feeling about their first?
I think a lot of writers feel like that. I mean, the book that you love is the one you're working on now.
Yeah,
right?
Always.
So, and people always ask me at events, you know, what's your favourite of your books? And it's like, none. But I don't know. I don't feel, I kind of feel proud of what they've done for themselves out in the world, the books, but I don't. You know, I don't want to go and read them or anything.
No.
I did an interview years ago. I was interviewing Michelle de Kretzer about one of her books, and someone in the audience said, so when you go back and reread your books, you know, what do you think? And she just said, it's fantastic. She said in her beautiful voice, she said, well, I would not reread one of my books. That would be like necrophilia.
That's such a good description.
And it's, yeah, that's, you know, exactly. You don't really.
No.
I mean, every now and again you get asked to read something from it or whatever. And sometimes I have been surprised thinking, oh, that's better than I thought.
Yeah.
You know, or somebody wants to reprint a bit of it and you go, oh, I've forgotten that bit. That's quite good, that sentence. But, you know, as a whole, it's not something that interests me to
let
think
them
about.
Go. Mm. Charlotte, one of the reasons I reached out to you before the mentorship was because I was interested in how you talked about not being sure of what the natural way of things was as you were writing it. And I'm really interested in how you talk about and interview people about process. Is this the same for each of your books, that you don't know what it is as you approach the material?
Well, the natural way of things was, you know, a strange, wild creature. So I feel like it's kind of an outlier in my books. It's this
sort of... In terms of the process too.
The process and the style and the content and all that. But I learned things from that I'm now taking into my work, which has been great. But, you know, that book was hard to write because I was afraid while I was writing a lot of it. And I was afraid of what it was saying about me, I suppose. Mm. Whereas the others have more kind of, they're more measured and, you know, there's not that kind of blind, visceral, you know, rage, I suppose. I had a great review in the Saturday paper for that and it said something like, reading this book is like swallowing a live creature, claws intact.
Oh,
and
it so is.
You know, and that's what it was like kind of writing it in a funny way.
Except you had to get it
out. It was like, oh, yes, I won't go into the metaphors and get it here. It's kind of horrid. But what, so I didn't know why it was forming it. I felt like it was doing it itself, which was actually a really great thing to accept, to embrace, because I think that's really helped me since. And I think, you know, I believe now that a book will tell you how to write it if you pay attention closely and you let go of your defences and your need to control the thing. But that, you know, it's hard to do that because it's very anxiety creating to not know.
Mm.
But I think writing is all about not knowing. You know, I write from a place of not knowing anything. Then the weekend I knew that I wanted to write about friendship and about getting older. So it was much more straightforward, even though there were periods during the writing of it that I thought, oh, I can't make this freaking thing work. Bummer. And, you know, had a little bit, I think I was actually a bit burnt out from all the talking and touring and stuff for the Natural Way of Things. So I took 6 months off entirely, which I'd never done.
Off writing.
Off writing.
Wow.
And off thinking about, I mean, I'd taken time away because I had to, because I did work and whatever. But I'd still be thinking about it or taking notes or whatever. But I had 6 months where I thought, I'm not going to think about writing at all.
That makes me think about the beautiful book, which I saw you recommend, Vicky Hastrich's Night Fishing.
Amazing book.
Where she talks about the fallow period.
The fallow period. That was watching her, you know, I know Vicky quite well, and watching her through that period was really amazing because she had been hurt by trying to make this magnificent novel come together, and she just let go, you know. She stepped out and said, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to put it aside and have a fallow year. So she made a project of her fallow year, which was, and the fallow year for her meant reading and looking at art and looking at nature and, you know, just and she did not set out to write a book about it, but out of that fallow year emerged at a certain point this unbelievably beautiful memoir that is essays about art and the ocean and childhood. And I mean, it's so complex and beautiful and interesting.
It's quite extraordinary. Charlotte, my copy of the Writer's Room interviews is so dog-eared and tattered, and it's my most recommended. And I think each time I dive into it, I'm like, I'm sure I have not read this interview before, because whatever stage in my process I'm at, I'm looking at something different in what comes out of those interviews. And I know you talked about it being a kind of a masterclass for you as you were writing too. What is it that interests you so much about talking with writers and creatives about the creative process?
I don't know, but I feel like I want to do it again now. Like I'm sort of missing it a bit. Well, you know, it was kind of sneaky way of just getting a whole lot of really great advice.
Oh, I know. Myself. I know the feeling. Welcome to our podcast.
I love writing that book. So it started as a what I fancily called an online digital magazine, which was a PDF file.
Yeah.
I love the Paris Review interviews.
Yeah.
And I've always gotten so much out of those. And I wanted an Australian, you know, it sounds very highfalutin, but an Australian version of that, but a writer talking to another writer. We have lots and lots of interviews with writers, but mainly they're by journalists.
Yeah.
And they ask completely different questions. Yeah. And I also wanted to talk to writers who were in the middle of a project. Mm. So I didn't approach anyone when they had a new book out to do that kind of interview. And I loved seeing how they were so open and generous with their thoughts about what was happening for them. I read, you know, as much of their work as I could find and everything beforehand. And I did ask about books, but mainly about elements of books that I, you know, were teaching me something about writing. And the one thing I did that I think helped make them so generous was to give them complete control over the final version. So I said, we're going to do this. I'm going to send you a transcript. You can change whatever you like and, you know, take stuff out, add stuff, whatever, which is how the Paris Review interviews work, I believe. And I think that made them feel very safe and in control. And they hardly changed anything in there. You know, when I sent it to them, occasionally they'd change a word here or there or add something if they thought they hadn't been clear enough. But they didn't retract anything or think, oh, no, you can't say that.
You created a very safe space for them to
And I think, you know, writers don't get to talk about the kind of nerdy, you know, structure-y stuff very much. So a lot of them really liked it.
Is there a volume 2 coming soon?
No, I don't have time, but I thought I might try and do a little podcast.
Oh, you should definitely.
Well,
do a
but just a very occasional one, just to have a kind of, especially about books that I think have been overlooked that need to be celebrated. But anyway, who knows? God knows if I'll get time.
There's a great article in The Guardian, which we'll link to, where you talk about lessons learned from the writer's room interviews. Can you, off the top of your head, think about what the most significant kind of light bulb moments were for you?
Well, there are some that I've talked about ad nauseum, and the one that I still kind of carry with me as a sort of mantra is, I think it was the first interview I did, which was with Amanda Laurie. And Amanda said that she always wants a novel to have a message from another realm.
Mm.
And I was like, I think I was sort of turning this way with The Natural Way of Things. So I was writing The Natural Way of Things as I was doing those interviews. And it just gave me a way of articulating that. Well, she articulated it for me, which was a sense of the uncanny or the mysterious, something unknown that isn't then explained, you know. So I love that. And in fact, my first novel has a lot of very weird, oogie boogie, quite bizarre stuff in it. And then I just rejected that altogether and wrote these very, you know, straight realism books for a long time. And so with The Natural Way of Things, oddly, the book that it reminded me most of when I was writing it was my first novel, which was very strange.
And that element of fear and a bit of shame was so present in both of those. There's some element of truest self in.
I think said somewhere else that sometimes what I've noticed in you know, mentoring writers or watching writers or artists develop is that you sort of write your first book, which is often a quite truthful, essential expression of who you are. And then you suddenly think, when it's done, you think, oh, no, that's wrong. It's not because nobody else is doing it like that. So then you scurry away from that as fast as you can because you think, oh, I've fucked it up and I can't, you know, or I've revealed myself in this terrible way or whatever. So then you go about denying that stuff. But then eventually when you're kind of disillusioned and tired and, you know, sort of, you know, a bit undone by the publishing world, which can be really brutal. I have seen this happen again and again with people I know and writers saying, And look, I just got to a point where I thought, oh, bugger it. I don't give a shit anymore. I'm just going to write what I want to write. And then the work comes alive. And then, you know, these are often their most successful books when they've just given up caring so much or striving to get approval from the publishing world, the reader world, the bookselling world, all of that. And, you know, it's such a good lesson to try and get to grips with. You know, I don't know if you can until you go through some sort of disillusionment. But
the wonderful thing, the wonderful gift in those writer's room interviews too is seeing people at so many various stages in careers. And for me, knowing that, I'm in these first two bits, but having a feeling that I'll get there, you know, that there will be a career. And, you know, maybe my fifth book will be ace, you know, and so getting a sense of what a career looks like in writing. Because I think that's hard to fathom.
That's, for me and my best writing buddies, that's been the thing that we kind of talk about the most. Not career, but body of work.
Yeah, body of work. You know? Yep.
So, okay, this one didn't go so well as I wanted, but the body of work is what matters.
Yeah.
So you go onward and you've learned stuff from that and you, you know, you learn about the craft, but you also learn about the publishing world.
Yep.
You learn what matters. You learn who to trust. You learn all kinds of stuff. So, you know, an inverted commas failed book in the publishing world doesn't have to be all about loss, you know. It's like, wow, I learned all those things that I won't do again, or, you know, but also you can see what's valuable even in a book that didn't work the way you wanted it to.
You, I know such a widely shared speech of yours is your stellar acceptance speech, and there's a couple of reasons for that, I think, and we'll link to it. One of the things is that you talk about really hitting a block in the writing of The Natural Way of Things, and an email that you wrote to your writing pals. Can you tell us just a little bit about that?
I was at Varuna, and it was actually either the day of or the day after. I don't know if your listeners will remember this, but it was when Julia Gillard was the Prime Minister and there was that horrible thing about a menu at a Liberal Party fundraiser that talked about her in the most disgusting, misogynistic ways about her body, you know. Anyway, it was just vile. And it just, I know so many women who were just devastated by that. And it's funny in a way because it's kind of among the minor insults that she had, but it was so calculated and vile.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just felt like why am I writing this book? This ugly hatred is out there, and maybe I'm just adding to it, actually. Maybe I'm not doing anything to alleviate it, but I'm just wallowing around in it and adding more into the world, and I felt just bereft, really. So then I had to kind of, you know, as you do, pull yourself together and go, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to stop? No, because whatever happens with this weird, dark book, I want to finish it, because otherwise I'd feel like this stuff was still in me. I had to get it out of me. So within sort of a day, I think I wrote an email to my writing pals and said, oh God, yesterday was just a pit, but I've dragged myself out of it by making a list of why I should write. And so then I read that bit in the Stella speech. I can't even remember what they were now, but you know, it's about to make beauty. And because I have some talent, maybe. And I think if you have a talent, you're obliged to use it or you're wasting, you know, your, I won't say God-given, but, you know, funnily enough, I think about my parents, you know, they died young and they were very talented in all kinds of ways. And I feel like I owed them, in a way, to just do something with it. Anyway, I literally can't remember what else was on that list, but
I think that idea too, that idea of making art, that's why we make, why we make art. Do you think, Charlotte, that most, in your experience of talking to writers and in your own work, do most writers experience that absolute crisis of confidence, I cannot go on with this work or there is no
point,
meaning, there's no point to this work in each of their works?
I think writers who think deeply, which is most writers, yeah. I think, do come to that place at some time. And sometimes it's not till quite late in their careers. And they're the ones I kind of worry for in a way, because yeah. then it's like really devastating. Whereas, I mean, I've had a few, like the rejection of my second novel, for example, where I was really, really undone by that. And I'm so glad it happened with my second book and not my fifth book.
Yes.
Because that taught me, well, this is what it's like.
Yeah.
You better get used to it, you know. Not that it's bad, but it's just like you cannot predict what's going to happen. Mm. But I know that sense of, you know, it's so hard to make a living. As you would know, everybody struggles to, you know, to just get enough money to live. And that is, that financial strain cannot be, you know, the pressure of that can't be underestimated. But also just the thing that you work on a book for 3, 4, 5 years and send it out and it has such a short time to kind of show itself. And that can be very devastating for people when I know at least 2 people very well who have had their hearts broken by a book not doing what they'd hoped out in the world. But then they recovered and they wrote more. And that's, you know, what it's like. But if you never have one of those times, then I think you're lucky.
Mm.
But also maybe it's necessary.
Yeah, I think necessary. The other part of that Stella speech, which I think had so many women writers in particular kind of pumping their fists, was when there'd become this tradition almost, it had developed very quickly, of the winner giving away, donating some of their earnings. And you kind of said, you know what, I'm not going to, because this is an important prize and we need this money, will give me time and space to write. If you had the magic wand of arts funding in this country, like what is it that writers need? How can we make a system where they get that?
Well, I don't think you can make a system where they get that. What we need is people to read and people to buy books.
Yeah.
We need a greater cultural interest in literature. So until we all create that ourselves, then, you know. But also maybe, you know, technology has changed everything and, you know, people say, oh, we're reading more than ever before because everyone's reading, you know, Facebook or whatever. Well, I don't really buy that. So the first thing we need is people to read books. The second thing we need is greater funding for literature, even within the Australia Council, which is a fantastic organisation that I love dearly and I spent some time working for. But the way arts funding is quarantined by the government means that most of the funding the Australia Council gets goes to the major performing arts companies and their funding, that funding will never, when there are funding cuts to the Australia Council, that their money is quarantined. So the people who lose are writers, musicians and visual artists. But literature gets the lowest proportion of funding within the Australia Council and I'd dearly love to see that change. What else do we need?
I loved that listening to you talk about your residency at Charles Perkins Centre, because and that this is where you wrote part of the weekend. And the wonderful thing I heard you say about it too was that there was nothing attached to that. Mm. You get this space, you get this these extraordinary networks to work within, and you get the generous stipend that you get.
Yeah, $100,000 for a year.
$100,000. And your job is to write.
Yeah.
Like it's such an extraordinary kind of thing.
Wait a minute. This can't be right. But this is right. And I mean, that's the other thing I would love to see is a lot more philanthropy for literature. And Judy Harris is the woman who has incredibly become the patron of the Charles Perkins Centre Writer in Residence Fellowship. The Charles Perkins Centre is a science research facility at the University of Sydney. It is a multidisciplinary facility, amazing place full of incredible brains from around the world, this amazing optimistic energy. People, you know, come from Harvard and Oxford to work there because it's this world-leading place. And yes, they have the residency, and the only stipulation is that you write your book. of course, when you're there, you take part in other things as you want to. I don't think there would be a writer taking up that opportunity and refusing to do anything. I think they do ask that if you could maybe do a public talk and talk to a writing class or something. Mm. But, of course, whatever your subject is, mine was ageing, but it's so wide-ranging that, you know, I ended up having conversations with all these people who had nothing to do with ageing and they're being incredibly useful. But, you know, the other writers who've been there since me, Alana Valentine, Mireille Duchaux, Emily Maguire, and this year just starting is Tracy Sorensen. Their subjects are all completely different, you know, hoarding and, you know, the gut biome and obesity but or intergenerational trauma and stuff. So there are all these people working there who have expertise in all these things, which is so wild and amazing.
You mentioned that you kind of opened up your process and you worked in the lunchroom. How did that work and did it change your process?
Well, one of the reasons it was so great to get that fellowship was that so I had written 5 novels and 2 books of nonfiction, and I think one thing writers can tend to do is get a bit superstitious about their process and that you have to, you know, this has always worked for me so I have to do it that way again. And sometimes I hear writers saying, oh, well, I couldn't work like that. Mm. And I think, oh, you could try it. And sometimes some of the people saying this, I'm thinking, well, maybe you should try it because what you're doing isn't really working. Mm. But there's a sort of pride sometimes in writers about this is the way I work. Mm. And I want to be able to change all the time, you know, to be open to change. So one of the reasons it was so great at that time was that you can start to fall into the same sort of patterns in the way you approach the work or just even the structure of the book. I mean, I'm now getting kind of like every time I start something, I'm like, oh, no, I can't do that because that's like animal people but by the sea. Or that one's like the children, but or that one's like the natural way of things but with, you know, dogs or I don't know. So you kind of think, oh, I need new, you know, fresh fields. So the fresh field of the Charles Perkins Centre Fellowship was this sort of promise I made to myself that I would, while I was there, I would be completely open to talking about my book to anyone who wanted to know. And this is a very embryonic book, which is, you know, got no, I hadn't written anything yet. I had an idea, but I didn't really have any words on the page. And often talking too much in an early stage of a book I think can be dangerous because even people saying nice things can make you think, oh, you know, if you say, oh, I'm working on blah, blah, and they go, oh, that bit's interesting. And you think, oh, I wasn't interested in that bit. But then you think, well, maybe I should be. So you can go down wrong track. I mean, go down wrong tracks anyway. But so this being really open about my prose, well, about the book, led to a whole lot of really interesting conversations and to being influenced, you know, when before that I'd always wanted to not be influenced. So it was really fascinating. And one of the kind of really clear examples is when I was talking to a guy called Professor David Robenheimer, who's a nutritional ecologist and works on the ways that certain kinds of monkeys regulate their protein and carbohydrate intake.
So specific.
So
love it.
And, you know, so unlike anything that would go in a literary novel about older women. But, and he said in this way that was sort of quite forward, I felt at the time, that he would like to see some evolutionary biology in my book, in this book of yours. And I was like, so ordinarily my response would be to internally go, see you later, buddy. Yeah, what the hell are you talking about? Yeah. Back off. Don't interfere with my, you know, creative process. But because I'd made that promise to myself, I kept talking to him and saying, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, animal aging is so much more accelerated than human aging. It'd be interesting to compare those things. And again, I sort of thought, yeah, but no. But then led me to instantly thinking about my friend Prue's very elderly dog who was dementing and, you know, heading towards having to be euthanized. And it really, then I could see immediately how useful a very elderly, dementing, slightly incontinent dog could be in my book.
In your book.
And that there's no way I would have got there without that conversation. And the dog is kind of crucial.
Yeah.
The book wouldn't be.
No.
I couldn't have done it without.
Yeah. When the other thing that Finny, the dog, does is, he directs so much of the action, the tension, and I've heard you speaking about this too, about the ways in which you produce narrative tension in your works. He's a fantastic way. You also talked about how you can limit the time or the space. Are they the key features, you think? You've put them all in the weekend. They're all in there.
They're all in there. I know, I've got nothing left now for the next one. Well, that time and space thing is very, very useful for novelists, the kind of containment of time.
Because the weekend is the weekend. That's exactly
Yeah, it's 3 days.
Over Christmas.
Over Christmas. And I mean, the thing is to, and this is what I'm going to have to watch out for now, is to be able to do that without it being just a fallback mechanical thing, formula. And so I guess then what you do is introduce things that kind of muck up that a bit, and you have to play around with the interplay between those things. But Finn was so useful for just creating little sort of micro moments of tension, but also thematically he was perfect for showing, for being able to kind of be a mirror for our cultural attitudes towards aging. Because he's not doing anything terribly awful. He's just standing and staring at a wall, for example.
Yeah.
And that drives Jude, one of the main characters, completely. She can't stand it.
No.
But it's not like, why can't she stand it?
Yeah.
You know, that's the interesting thing.
And yeah, the
he's
way,
not suffering. No. He's not in pain. She says, well, you're just being cruel to this poor dog. You know, you should have him put down because you're just dragging him around like a rotting security blanket. But it's actually her problem with looking at, you know, what is happening at the end of this dog's life that is causing her to have those feelings.
Yeah. I can't let you go without asking you about one of, or I think the most significant lesson that I learned from you during my mentorship with you, which was about confidence as a discipline and choosing confidence and the way that we have to write with confidence and be writers with confidence. Mm. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
I see it because I was it as well. And I mean, in some ways, I don't know if you can, I don't know if you have to go through the sort of underconfident stuff first. But basically, I got to a point where I was just sick of being so pathetic, you know, in terms of my confidence. I was bored with it. And then I read an academic paper by a friend of mine where she had interviewed Tim Winton, and she asked him about confidence, and he said, confidence is a discipline. And I then took that and sort of misquoted it as confidence is a decision.
Huh.
But I think both of those things are correct.
Yeah.
And the other person I spoke to about this in the writer's room was Emily Perkins, the fantastic New Zealand writer. And she said, yes, she had got to a point in her university years of watching, of feeling very, you know, of waiting for confidence to come. And if I do this long enough, then something will happen and confidence will be bestowed on me by the world. And she said, but I was watching these blokes in my year who were making music and, you know, doing all kinds of creative stuff. And she said, and none of them were like this. They just weren't sort of sitting around waiting for approval. They were just making their stuff and doing it and not wasting time by thinking, oh, am I allowed to do it? And no, I'm not confident. And I'm so full of doubt and blah, blah, blah. And she said, and I just thought, fuck this, I'm just going to pretend I'm them. And really that thing of faking it till you make it, I think really works. It's like, well, pretend you're a confident person. Just do it. And let's just not be too little girly about it. I got really sick of my little girly self being so sensitive and worried and, you know, and I think writers are very sensitive people. And they have to be, but you also need to just take charge and seize some authority over your own work and your own life, you know?
That is wonderful advice for our listeners. Charlotte Wood, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kate. So fun. Thanks.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Ady. The First Time Podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.